Encourage you to take your Bibles and open them to the book of Joshua. We'll be continuing our study through the Old Testament books. I wasn't sure if the reason why our numbers were so low is because people don't want to hear the book of Joshua or they don't want to hear me preach. I wasn't sure which one it was. Now, we do have a number that are away, and so keep them in your prayers that everybody gets back to their own destinations, their own locations as soon as possible, and all is well. Book of Joshua. Of course, we've covered the first five books of the Old Testament. If we could ever make this much progress in our Wednesday night Bible studies, we'd be in Revelation by now. But we're still in Genesis. But there's a shift between Deuteronomy and Joshua. Deuteronomy concludes the law, the five books of the law, the Pentateuch. It ends that establishing of God giving His laws to the nation of Israel. And from Joshua through Esther, you have the history of the nation. Now, there's going to be history that's contained in Genesis through Deuteronomy, and as it pertains to Israel, Exodus through Deuteronomy. And there's history that goes from Job all the way to Malachi. But these books are the books of history. They are considered the books of history because they contain mainly historical narrative. They are not the prophets speaking to Israel, though it does contain some of that. But predominantly it is the accounting of the history of Israel. Now, something else that you need to bear in mind is, again, when you deal with these books, you've got the Old Testament out of chronological order. Because from Joshua to Esther, when you put all those books together and you look at the chronology of those books, you have a full and complete history of Israel all the way up until the end of the book of Malachi. And so all the books of the prophets and the books of the Psalms fit into these books in the chronology of the history of Israel. And so that's important to realize that chronologically, by the time you get to the end of the book of Esther, you're at the end of Israelite history by way of historical narrative. The remainder of the books fit into the time frame of these 12 books. Now, they can be broken down into three different sections. Joshua through Ruth deals with the history of the independent tribes. That is, each tribe was under their own elders, under their own leaders, and they all were under God, or at least they should have been. In 1 Samuel through 2 Chronicles, you have the history of the kingdom. The kingdom, the nation of Israel as a kingdom being ruled by kings. Starting with Saul. And then Ezra through Esther, you have the history of the return from captivity and their dependency on foreign rulers. Because from that point forward, there wouldn't be a true king in Israel from the end of the events of Ezra, Nehemiah, and Esther all the way until Christ comes in the first century. There is no true king over the nation of Israel from the end of those books to the New Testament. So they will, throughout that 400 years of silence, they will be under the reign of someone else, including the years that are found in Ezra through Esther. They will be ruled by someone else one way or another. The theme of the book of Joshua, though, is the fidelity of God. It is God delivers on His promises. And that's what we're going to find here. All the promises God has made from Genesis to Deuteronomy to Abraham, to Isaac, to Jacob, to Israel, to the people coming out of the land of Egypt into the land of Palestine, all of them are fulfilled by way of the land promise. They are fulfilled in Joshua in a correct understanding. We'll get into that a little bit more later. The author is believed to be Joshua. This is the same kind of discussion concerning the authorship of Joshua as there was with the book of Deuteronomy. The book of Joshua, Joshua 24, speaks of the death of Joshua and Eleazar the high priest. So if it contains his death, how could it be written by him? We went over this last week with the death of Moses. It could either be that God inspired Joshua to write concerning his own death, or it could be that it was finished by another individual, the next high priest, Phinehas, or I think I've got him in the wrong order, but anyway, the next high priest. It could be a number of different options as to if someone else finished it, but certainly plausible that God simply gave it to him by prophecy. So it deals no detriment to Joshua as the author or to inspiration. The date of the book, most likely around 1350 BC. So we've progressed on from the time of Moses. We're down to about 1350. There's evidence that the book was written by one who had been an eyewitness to the events. Joshua chapter 5 verse 1 is written in second person. We crossed the Jordan. First person, plural. Not second person. That would be you crossed the Jordan. Notice also that the indication of the text from Joshua chapter 6 is Rahab is still alive when the book is being written. And then Joshua chapter 24 verse 26 speaks of Joshua's writing all or part of the material in the book. So all of these things indicate Joshua as the author. Purpose of the book. Purpose of the book is to tell the story of the conquest of the dividing of the promised land. It's really quite that simple. That's the main thrust behind the book. Israel comes into the land. God gives them a land. Israel divides the land. Also, second purpose is to demonstrate that God keeps His word. You go back to Genesis chapter 12, verses 1 through 3, and that initial call to Abraham to come out of Ur of the Chaldees and go to a land that I will show you, and I will give this land to you and to your descendants. And that promise is continued in chapter 22, verse 17. And you follow that promise up, and the land of Canaan was included in God's promise. And He promises to give it to the seed. The ultimate seed that would bless the nations is Christ, but Abraham's descendants would inherit the land. The book of Joshua shows that the Hebrews ultimately occupy the land of Canaan in accordance with the divine purpose and promise, and as a proof of God's fidelity to His covenant. Joshua chapter 1 verse 6 says, "All has come to pass." And then Joshua chapter 21, verses 43 through 45. Notice that passage real quick. Joshua 21, verses 43 through 45. "So the Lord gave to Israel all the land which He had sworn to give to their fathers, and they took possession of it and dwelt in it. The Lord gave them rest all around according to all that He had sworn to their fathers, and not a man of all their enemies stood against them. The Lord delivered all their enemies into their hand. Not a word failed of any good thing which the Lord had spoken to the house of Israel. All came to pass." Now, some have taken the book of Joshua and they said, well, no, everything didn't come to pass. Because when you begin to see God's explanations earlier about what portion of the land of Canaan and how much of the land of Canaan they would possess, you don't see all of them reaching all of those borders when you go back into the promises in the earlier books. Something to remember, a couple of things to remember, and again, we'll deal with this a little bit more later on. Number one, God told them, Exodus chapter 23, turn there. Exodus chapter 23, verse 23. There's two factors that come into this that make it very clear that what God stated, He fulfilled. What Joshua wrote is true. Exodus chapter 23, verse 23. For my angel will go before you and bring you into the Amorites and to the Canaanites, the Hivites and the Jebusites, and I will cut them off. You shall not bow down to their gods, nor serve them, nor do according to their works, but you shall utterly overthrow them and completely break down their sacred pillars. So you shall serve the Lord your God, and He will bless your bread and your water, and I will take sickness away from the midst of you. No one shall suffer miscarriage or be barren in your land. I will fulfill the number of your days. I will send my fear before you. I will cause confusion among all the people to whom you come, and will make all your enemies turn their backs to you. And I will send hornets before you, which shall drive out the Hivites, the Canaanite, and the Hittite from before you. And I will not drive them out from before you in 1 year, lest the land become desolate and the beasts of the field become too numerous for you. Little by little I will drive them out from before you until you have increased and you inherit the land. And I will set your bounds from the Red Sea to the Sea Philistia, and from the desert to the river, for I will deliver the inhabitants of the land into your hand, and you shall drive them out before you. You shall make no covenant with them, nor with their gods. They shall not dwell in your land, lest they make you sin against me, for if you serve their gods, it will surely be a snare to you. So, when God promised to give them the land, He did exactly what He promised to do, but God gave a caveat to it. He said, you're going to get the land gradually as far as the full portion of the land. Well, when you go and look at what God promised they would receive, and then you go over, I believe it's to 1 Kings chapter 4, and you read about the land that Solomon ruled, guess what? It's the full and complete fulfillment of everything God had said. It was the whole land that Israel was promised to possess during David and Solomon's time. They ruled all of it. And so it is gradual that God gives the full amount, but God brings them into the land. He gives them the land. He allows them to have the land. There's a second part to that, though. When you notice what takes place in the land, when you notice what happens, you'll also notice that God not only gives them the land, but He also makes a qualification. He says, I'm going to bring you into the land. I'm going to deliver them into your hand if you trusted me and be obedient. Now, we noticed this morning, in the lesson this morning, that we already have one group of cities that isn't going to get destroyed, the Gibeonites and others around their area, Joshua chapter 9 and Joshua chapter 10, because the Gibeonites deceived Israel. They made a covenant with them because they didn't talk to God first. They didn't check to make sure that they should make this covenant with this people, and they didn't know the Gibeonites were in the land. So there's already one section that's not going to get destroyed like God said. But as you progress through the book of Joshua, you're going to see God bringing out some of these battles are not going to be won to the extent that they could have been because Israel didn't do what Israel should have done. And Joshua is even going to accuse some of the tribes, 7 of them, of not taking their land as they should have. And so there's not only the issue of them getting it gradually as God said they would, but there's also the aspect of them not being obedient and taking the land and trusting in God to deliver it to them. So those two things are aspects of this promise, but the reality is still the same. God has delivered on His promises to Israel. Notice the third purpose is to show the consequences of disobeying God's will. God keeps His promises and He'll keep His threatenings as well. When you look back at Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim and God giving them the blessings and the cursings, Leviticus chapter 26, God said, if you obey me, you're going to be blessed. If you disobey, if you turn your back on me, you will be cursed and you will be driven out of the land just like the former inhabitants were. And that's, of course, exactly what's going to happen. Then the background of the book of Joshua. It is so named for its author and principal character. It is a record of the conquest and division of Canaan over a period of about 50 years. It is largely a story of military campaigns in which God fought for the Jews. Jericho and Ai are taken, dividing the land in half. Israel is going to come in. If you look at a map, they're going to come in almost smack dab in the middle of the land. And they're going to cut the north off from the south. And they're going to proceed to take one at a time. The southern part of the country is conquered, and then the north. They basically come into the land, they sweep down south, turn up, and go north. And that will be their process of conquering the cities. Joshua the man, for about 40 years, Joshua served Moses as his minister. We're introduced to him at the Battle of Rephidim, and we'll mention some more on that in a moment. But his name originally was Hoshea, Numbers chapter 13 and verse 8, which means salvation. Moses will change his name to Jehoshea, which means Jehovah is salvation. But he's also called Yeshua, a shortened form of Yehoshua. And in the Hebrew, the term Joshua is equivalent to the Greek Jesus. So, when you turn over to Hebrews chapter 4, which you should do, Hebrews chapter 4, some of the translations have corrected this. Hebrews chapter 4 and verse 8, I believe it's specifically the King James, I'm not sure about the ASV, reads verse 8, "For if Jesus had given them rest, then he would not afterward have spoken of another day." Now, the statement there is correctly transliterated from the Greek, Jesus. But Jesus in the Greek and Joshua in the Greek from the Hebrew are the exact same name. And the reference is to Joshua. So it should be translated as Joshua for the benefit of those who are reading it, not recognizing the fact, or not knowing the fact, that Jesus and Joshua are the same person in this passage. It's simply a process of the transliteration and changing of the names from one language to another. So that's important to realize and be aware of, especially if you have one of the translations that doesn't change it correctly. The context is not concerning Jesus. It is concerning Joshua. We know nothing of his home life, other than we read in Joshua chapter 24 and verse 15, "As for me and my house," that indicates he has a family, but we have no idea. We have no explanation, no details concerning his wife, his children, his descendants, none at all. They just simply are not talked about. Joshua appears first at Rephidim when the Amalekites come to fight against Israel, Exodus chapter 17, verses 1 through 13. And it is under Joshua's leadership that the Israelites, actually doing battle, his military leadership, that they will have a complete victory. He called Moses' attention to the noise of the people. He was one who got to go part way up the mount when Moses went up to receive the law. And as Moses is coming down, he brings to Moses' attention the clamor that is happening down below, which of course we recognize was the Israelites bowing down to the golden calf. He is found in closest attendance of Moses, Exodus chapter 33 and verse 11. Joshua and Caleb exhibited faith in God by bringing back the only good reports from being two of the 12 spies sent into the land 38 years earlier. And he was chosen to be the next leader of Israel after Moses' death, chosen by God. Joshua will die at the age of 110, according to Joshua chapter 24, verse 29. Some keys to the book. Key word, conquest, possession, either one of those. The idea of the taking of land and possessing that land. Key verses, Joshua chapter 21, verses 43 through 45, what we just read, concerning God fulfilling all that He had commanded to or promised to Israel. Key chapters, chapter 23 and 24, as Joshua gives that final speech, that final presentation before Israel, telling them, here's where you go from now on. Here's where you go forward. Here's what you must do. Here's what you must agree to do and follow after God. But understand, if you turn aside, God will destroy you. He commanded them, verse 14 of chapter 24, to fear the Lord and to serve Him in sincerity and in truth. Key phrase, choose you this day whom you will serve. Outline of the book of Joshua, and as we've done before, we'll just simply cover the broad outline, and you can go through and look at the individual chapters and the things specified in there as you have opportunity. You have chapters 1 through 12, which are the taking of the land, the conquest of the land, the introduction to Joshua as leader is in chapter 1, and then chapters 2 through 12, you have the land being taken. Then chapters 13 through 22, you have the dividing of the land. That is the dividing of the individual inheritances within the land. Each tribe given their own inheritance, of course, with the Levites being excluded from that. They received inheritance among the other tribes. Then the dividing of the land to tribes of Israel and Joshua's retirement is chapters 23 and 24. Christ in the book of Joshua. Really, there is not much connection to Christ in a definitive sense, other than you see Joshua and Christ somewhat as type antitype in Joshua bringing them into the promised land. Well, when you bring the types of the promised land and Jordan and life and death over into the New Testament, you've got that idea of an individual crosses the Jordan, typified in death, and they cross into the promised land, they cross into heaven, and how does that occur? Through Christ. And so you've got that leadership aspect, you've got the deliverance aspect, you've got a number of those different ideas that are really brought together in that typological relationship, though it's not described that way in the New Testament per se. Some lessons from the book of Joshua, and this is where, of course, we will spend the majority of our time that we have remaining. Number one, courage and confidence should be a characteristic of God's people. With the knowledge that God is faithful and worthy of our trust, we should possess the courage and confidence of success that results from any such relationship. We need to be those who are willing to put our trust in God, because that's what faith is. It's trusting in God that He's going to do what He has promised. This courage is not a result of our abilities, but the trust we have in God's power to accomplish His purpose. And that's what God emphasizes to Joshua. There at the beginning of the book, Joshua chapter 1, verses 5 through 6, he says, be strong and of a good courage. But he tells him to not depart from the law. He says, you take the law that was given to Moses and all that Moses commanded, and you bring it into your heart, you study it, you read it, you know what it says, and you don't depart from it to the left hand or the right. And why? He says, because I'm going to bring you into the land and I'm going to deliver you every step of the way, and everything that you do will prosper if you obey the commands, if you're willing to trust me. And if he had to obey the commands in order for God to deliver the land into his hand, that meant it wasn't him that was doing it. He was simply obeying. God was doing the delivering. God was doing the conquering. And such will be apparent. Joshua, 30 years later, would admonish the children of Israel to be very courageous, to keep and to do all that is written in the book of the law of Moses. So you begin the book, God telling Joshua, keep all the commandments in the law. You end the book with Joshua telling the people, keep all the commandments in the law. God's people must be courageous and convinced that God will guard that which we have, which has been committed unto God against that day, as Paul describes 2 Timothy chapter 1, verse 12. Number two, God is at war with sin. There is no doubt of that idea when you read the book of Joshua, when you see the condemnation and the continual instruction that all the people of the land were to be destroyed entirely, is that God had declared war against the Canaanites and would be victorious. You notice also that the idea of God at war with Israel because of sin. They go up against Ai after Achan has taken that which belongs to God out of the spoils of Jericho, and God defeats them. It's not Ai that defeats them. It's God that defeats them. He uses Ai to do it, but they're defeated, and Joshua knows. As soon as the people come back defeated, he knows that God's done it. And he's trying to figure out what's going on. And God says, there's sin in the camp. That which was mine has been taken. Notice also the miracles of Joshua. That is, miracles in the book of Joshua. You've got the crossing of the Jordan River, very similar to when they crossed the Red Sea under Moses' leadership. They will cross the Jordan River. It will stand up on either side just as it did before. God says the priests who are carrying the Ark of the Covenant, when their souls hit the water will divide and they will cross on dry ground. And you begin to notice the scope of what would happen. And not only just the fact that it would be dry ground, but it's specifically stated in the text that the Jordan River was at its overflow season. During the season of the harvest, the Jordan would overflow its banks every year. And it's that season that God says, you're going across. It would have been typically the season where people didn't cross the Jordan River. You don't choose to cross the river at flood season. You go when it's lower. Well, not when you're God. God says, you go now. And as soon as the heels of the priest carrying the Ark of the Covenant hit the banks of the Jordan, it divided, and the people crossed. That's found, of course, in Joshua chapter 3. The fall of Jericho, Joshua chapter 6. We should all be familiar with that. God tells them, here's the battle plan. You march around the city one time, one day. You march around the city another time, the next day. Another time, next day. Next day, next day, next day. Seventh day, you march around it seven times. Then you blow the trumpets. You shout. And the walls will come down. And they did. And it's not insignificant that these weren't puny, you know, these aren't the kind of walls that you think of when you think back to the days of the Indians and the Wild West and the forts that they made, and you see the trees and the wood forts. No, that's not this kind of city. Bear in mind, you should remember that Rahab's house was built into the wall. They dwelled inside their walls. That's how big and wide these walls were. It is spoken of many cities in ancient times where they could have chariot races on the tops of the walls, three chariots abreast. And generally you figure the width of two horses plus wheels, and you put three of those side by side by side, and they could race without running into one another on the tops of these walls. These were not small walls. And keep in mind as well, the children of Israel didn't have siege engines. They didn't have the machines of war that were even in existence in those days. They didn't have those. They brought the walls down with trumpets and shouting, because God brought the walls down. The battle at Gibeon, again, is another miracle of God. You have not only the miracle where God brings hail down upon the people, the kings, as they're trying to escape, and more individuals were killed by the hail than God rain down from heaven, then were killed by the swords of the Israelites. But as well, during that battle, Joshua requests or asks that the sun stand still. It's more like a command. He just said for the sun to stand still. And it's even brought out there within the text, if you look at Joshua chapter 10, that there has been no day like that, verse 14, before it or after it, that the Lord heeded the voice of a man, for the Lord fought for Israel. It was not, God, can you please have the sun stand still? Joshua looked up to heaven and commanded the sun to stand still. And God heeded his voice, for God fought for Israel. Then you also have the ceasing of the manna that takes place here in the book of Joshua. God has provided for Israel for almost 40 years through the wilderness wanderings, through the time at Sinai, by giving them manna from heaven. And now, as it miraculously started, it miraculously stops. And God ceases that provision. Another lesson that we have from the book of Joshua is God is greater than the gods of this world. It was not the case that these people who were in the land did not have their own deities. Oh, they did. They had their own gods that they worshiped. They had their own pagan gods that they sacrificed to. That's why God continually reminded Israel, you don't follow their gods. You don't go to their gods. You don't make a covenant with their gods. You don't serve their gods. For I am the one and true living God. God shows his superiority over every deity in Canaan because they were destroyed and their people were as well. God drove the Canaanites out of the land. He demonstrated his righteousness and his holiness. The destruction of the Canaanites is always presented in Scripture as a judgment of God because of their wickedness. This wasn't an arbitrary God decided, well, I like Israel better, therefore I'm going to kill all of these people off and put them in the land. That's not it. Matter of fact, you go back to the statements earlier on in the Pentateuch, and God told Abraham, you're not going to inherit the land yet because the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet full. This is the iniquity of the people dwelling in the land. I haven't reached the end of my long suffering. But by the time Joshua and the people come out of Egypt, God has. God has said, I've reached the end. They had this much time to change, to repent, to fix the problems. They haven't done it, and now they're going to be destroyed. And it's no less just for God to bring Israel into the land than for God later on to turn around and bring Babylon or Assyria down into Israel's land and to kill them off and to drive them out of the land because they did the same thing that the Canaanites did. There's no less righteousness on God's part. As a matter of fact, it's always God's righteousness that brings about these results. They had not only apostatized from God, but had fallen into forms of idolatry of the most degrading kind. And you can do some reading on that. God chose to inflict his righteous judgment by the hands of the Israelites and expressly commissioned them to be his executioners. God has authority to judge on this earth. We often understand and speak of and have no problems with God being able to judge eternally. Well, God's judgment doesn't end where the world begins. God's judgment, his authority, exists in this life as well. God revealed through Joshua that if the Israelites started to serve foreign gods, then God would do to them in like manner as he had done to the Canaanites. They had their warning. Our influence will live on after we depart from this life. This is another lesson that we can learn from Joshua. Joshua chapter 24, verse 31. Israel served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders who outlived Joshua, who had known all the works which the Lord had done for Israel. And it's telling that Israel continued to serve God, continue to remain faithful. And the idea isn't solely that it was because, only because of Joshua and these elders still being alive. But it was their influence that they had on the people that they continued to remain faithful, and they stayed that way until those elders died. But once the next generation came along, the leadership was not there. Another lesson that we can learn is compromise with sin brings disaster. Achan compromised by taking part of the spoils from Jericho for himself when all of them belonged to God. And when the Israelites started sparing the lives of the Canaanites through compromise, receiving tribute money from them, they were guaranteeing problems with these people later on. When they started accepting tribute instead of destruction, that's when they could rest assured that they were going to deal with these people, and these people were going to be a thorn in their side from that point forward. And they were. They were a constant issue in Israel. Then, ultimately, some typical and spiritual lessons for us. Number one, we do not need to entertain any doubts about the goodness and justice of God in dispossessing the Canaanites. As we already talked about, God gave them their opportunity. And it's not as though these people were without any knowledge of God. They knew who God was going back in the generations. They were descendants of Noah. They were descendants of Canaan. They had a history of knowing who God was. But not only that, Abraham had dwelled in the land previously. Lot had dwelled in the land previously. Isaac had dwelled in the land previously. Jacob had dwelled in the land previously. And we even know of cities, when you go back to those individuals' times, that were righteous, that served God. But on top of that, going forward in history, you have the Midianites, some of whom, at least, were those who served God. Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, by all indications, was a priest of God. So there's influence in the land. When you go forward to the book of Numbers, and you see where Balaam is called in to curse Israel. By all indications of the text, Balaam was actually a prophet of God. Now, he did not act in accordance with what God commanded him, so he was in error and he sinned. But all indication of what Balaam says and the way God interacts with him is that Balaam was actually a prophet of God in the land of Midian. And so you have influences all around the Canaanites, from the descendants of Abraham through Ishmael and through the Midianites and others, that they could have known what they needed to do. They could have changed from their ways. They could have turned their back on their sin and their idolatry and their paganism, but they didn't. And God brought judgment on them. Number two, God's gifts are free, but man must take them according to God's directions. Joshua chapter 6. God didn't give the city of Jericho to the Israelites and say, take it however you want to. God gave them instructions. And God gave commands. And they had to do exactly what God had commanded them. God offers us grace. Ephesians chapter 2, verse 8. We are saved by faith through grace. That doesn't mean we don't have to obey. God still stipulated how it is that we're saved by faith through grace. And that not of ourselves. It is the gift of God. Well, Israel didn't take Jericho without it being a gift from God. Ai was a gift from God, but they still had to be obedient in order to take those gifts. Number three, sin always hinders God's people in their pursuit of victory in any endeavor. Whether it be the sin in the camp of Israel, Joshua chapter 7, or sin in the congregations of our Lord, it always hinders God's people and His work from being done. The God of Joshua was, number four, a personal God, yet a supernatural God, capable of performing the most awe-inspiring miracles. Again, we noticed those miracles earlier. Joshua chapter 3, Joshua chapter 10, Joshua chapter 6, and others. In carrying out the work of Jehovah, God expects man to use the best of human reasoning. Campbell stated this, at least as quoted by James Meadows, strategy without obedience is useless. Obedience includes the use of reason, the employment of common sense. God expects us, even today, to be obedient to Him and use reason, wisdom, knowledge, understanding, instruction, and all of these things that delve into the concept of human reason, common sense. God does not expect us to go throughout obeying His commands without thinking. God didn't want robots. If He had wanted robots, He would have made robots. He made free will people who had the ability to choose. Even in the cities that were the gifts of God, Joshua 6 through 8, Joshua still used strategy of good warfare. Then the book also reveals two great reasons why we fail to possess our possessions God has given us. Number one, disobedience to God's commands. You disobey and all bets are off. God said, you get this if you're obedient, if you remain faithful to me. And when we refuse to remain faithful, when we refuse to obey, the same results will occur. But then as well, another point from Joshua is slackness in taking our possessions as seven of the tribes were guilty of. Now the idea of slack, according to Eric Hayden, means to wax feeble, to forsake, to leave, to weaken, to cease. Weariness had crept in among Israel. First, enthusiasm had waned. Efforts became too much trouble. Lack of inertia, lack of effort, is one of the most deadly diseases in our churches. In the end, it results in having to call in, as he states, a professional evangelist to do what the ordinary membership should have been doing for years. It's sad to say, but there are some congregations that simply cannot function without a full-time preacher. Now, that's not to say that a congregation can always function to its fullest capacity and productivity without all the components that God has laid out. But there's some congregations that simply do not function at all. No one does anything if there's not a full-time preacher. And when there is a full-time preacher, the majority of the time they rely on him to do everything. And that's not right. That's the same idea that the people had. They just expected it to just happen. They expected it to just be done. They expected them to just walk out of the land, I guess, and they could take it. But God didn't set it up that way. God requires something from all of us, and He requires work on all of our behalfs. And then finally, Israel's conflict in Palestine is typical of our struggles against the forces of darkness. Paul said in the church at Ephesus, you have to fight the good fight. He says that to Timothy, but he says, lay hold on the armor of God. You got to dress for battle. You've got to be clothed for the warfare that exists in this world as Christians. In conclusion, something that's significant in the book of Joshua are the memorials. Joshua chapter 4 and in verse 7, they cross over Jordan, and notice what Joshua does. The statement made in verse 7, then you shall answer them. Let me step back. Verse 4, then Joshua called the 12 men whom he had appointed from the children of Israel, one man from every tribe. And Joshua said to them, cross over before the ark of the Lord your God in the midst of the Jordan, and each of you take up a stone on his shoulder according to the number of the tribes of the children of Israel, that this may be a sign among you when your children ask in time to come, saying, what do these stones mean to you? Then you shall answer them that the waters of the Jordan were cut off from before the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord when it crossed over the Jordan, and the waters of the Jordan were cut off, and these stones shall be for a memorial to the children of Israel forever. You step over to Joshua chapter 22. Joshua 22, and the fighting is finished, and God had told the 2.5 tribes, you remember there's 2.5 tribes on the other side of Jordan? Back when they possessed their land in the book of Numbers, God told them, you're still going into the land. You're still going with your brothers to help fight and to drive the people out of the land. You don't get to stay over here on this side of the Jordan and just sit on your heels. You've got to go into the land too. Joshua chapter 22, those 2.5 tribes get to go home. And as they cross the Jordan, they build an altar. And they called it Ed. E-D. Ed. Well, the other tribes on the other side thought they had made an altar to a pagan god and they got ready to attack. They got everybody together and they said, we've got to go take care of these 2.5 tribes over there because they built a pagan altar. So they come and they get prepared to attack and go into cross the Jordan, and the other tribes come over and say, what's going on? He said, no, we built this as a memorial. This is to remind the tribes on this side of the Jordan that we're still your people. That we're a part of this nation. That we belong to the God Most High. And that we will come over to serve Him where He places His name. So you have memorials. Reminders. Memorials are a good thing. We use memorials. Go to Washington, D.C. There's memorials all over the place. Why are they there? They're to remind people of what's happened in the past. Joshua established memorials to remind the people of what God had done. And such should be done even today. God fulfilled all His promises, and that which is established in this book is the fulfillment of those things. And then finally, the book of Joshua presents in the closing chapter a fitting close to any lesson. Choose you this day whom you will serve. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. The opportunity, the invitation is laid before you. Whom will you serve? Will you be as Israelites and serve the gods of those that your forefathers served? The gods of wealth, money, land, possessions, pride? Or will you serve God? And will you serve Him completely? If you have need to respond to the invitation, it's made available as together we stand and as we sing.